We're talking about processing trauma through exercise in a Milwaukee pilot program to empower women through movement. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Trauma-informed martial arts programs are on the rise, and they offer survivors more of a sense of power and control. Do you practice martial arts? Do you powerlift or appreciate kickboxing classes? How have these programs changed the way you think about your body? Do you release emotionally when you do high-intensity interval training? Join in 800-642-1234. Amber Tucker is an assistant professor of sociology at Cardinal Stritch University in Milwaukee, where she is part of the Restorative Justice in Movement research team, and she practices and teaches jiu-jitsu. Amber, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Hi, thank you for having me on.
Good morning. So introduce us to the program Restorative Justice in Movement.
Restorative Justice in Movement is a pilot program and also a funded research project by Marquette University. We're funded by the Institute for Women's Leadership and the President's Challenge for Racial Justice and Equity Response. It is a collaboration of researchers between Cardinal Stritch, where I am, and Marquette University. And it is a program where we run clinics, introductory clinics to jiu-jitsu, rock climbing, and powerlifting. And these are just all different ways of thinking about, we don't necessarily refer to it as exercise, just movement modalities. And so just a way to offer different ways of thinking about movement and how body movement, the connection between the mind and body, specifically related to like movement exercise, can help restore or help people process trauma.
When I think about martial arts or powerlifting or rock climbing, you have to trust and you have to get comfortable with movement in your body. Do you think that that's what sets this apart?
Yes. There are so many different benefits. There's emerging research on the benefit of martial arts. I know that there is. I'm connected with a woman in New Zealand, and she's working with like 20 people around the world, and they're working on building trauma-informed martial arts programs. But there has been some newer research that looks at the benefits of jiu-jitsu specifically, and they've been working with combat veterans with PTSD. And so the minimal research that's out has shown that there has been some reported improvements in overall mental health with jiu-jitsu. So specifically with jiu-jitsu, the other martial arts programs absolutely offer the same benefit, because the idea is restoring the connection between the mind and body that is often lost in the experience of trauma. You know, one of the common experiences, reported experiences, or description of what it's like after the experience of trauma is this loss of sense of self or sense of control over the body, because during the experience of trauma, you know, that's one of the disempowering aspects, is that you lose a sense of control over that moment and over yourself. I personally have experienced multiple forms of trauma, and I just anecdotally can speak to that experience. So that's how I would describe it. After some incidents, I was angry with myself because I didn't respond in the way that I wanted to respond. Instead, I responded automatically, which often happens during trauma. Our responses to high stress or crises or traumatic incidences are automatic. And so for me, my automatic response was freeze. And I was very upset after a couple of trauma incidents with myself, because I that's not the response I wanted to have. And through practicing martial arts, I was able to restore that sense of control over my body. And in fact, reprogram, it's the fight, flight, or freeze response that's automatically wired into our brain for survival. And I was able to rewire that response so that now my trauma response is fight and not freeze.
It sounds like you also gained confidence and assertiveness, and suddenly, or over time, you knew what your body was capable of doing.
Yes, absolutely. So jiu-jitsu, it's a sport. It's practiced as a combat sport. And so we think about sports. I think one of the things that may deter people from participating in it is the idea of athleticism and strength. And what I learned through jujitsu is that it is an intellectual sport. It's mat chess. Like, you have to, you know, anticipate the responses and moves ahead of time when you're practicing or sparring with another person. And so that ability to be able to, you know, think in a high stress situation. When we're in class and we're sparring, we put ourselves in high stress situations every day. And so over time, you learn to slow down and actually think rather than responding out of fear or a loss of a sense of control or safety. So for jujitsu specifically, that has helped me. And the confidence that you receive, the confidence that I received from it was because I was able to trust my body again. I was able to trust my body that it would do what my mind wanted my body to do. You know, sometimes after trauma, the disconnect between your mind and your body, your mind thinks one way, but your body responds the other way. Well, it helps to restore that connection because your mind and your body have to work together in order for you to have a great experience in training jujitsu.
We're talking with Amber Tucker, who is an assistant professor of sociology at Cardinal Stritch University in Milwaukee, part of the Restorative Justice in Movement research team that we're learning about. You can join in. What do you want to know about how these movements can affect trauma and mental health and that recovery? How has exercising helped you get through difficult times in your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. Amber, how are participants responding to these clinics? What have they told you?
So we do, my research team consists of Dr. Noelle Brigden from Marquette and Dr. Heather Havlicka from Marquette, and then Dr. Jennifer Oldendorf from Marquette, and also Madeline Wright, who assists us on our research project. So we do participatory action research. So we're actually in there in the clinics with the participants, participating with them. And so with that upfront and close observations, some of the impactful comments or feedback that I received from the women, I know, for example, we were doing a powerlifting clinic. And the first cycle that we ran this summer, we did an intergenerational project. So we were working with women and their children. Hmm. And there was a mother and a daughter and a teen daughter, and in the powerlifting clinic, we were doing deadlifts. And so when it was the daughter's turn, everyone, and especially the mother, she was, you know, cheerleading and encouraging. It's just like, you can do this, you can do this. And then so when she did one repetition of a deadlift, she was so excited and she clapped. And then when it was her turn to do it, she was hesitant. And she was like, oh, I don't know if I could do this. And so we tried to offer the same, including her daughter, with the same encouragement and support that she was providing for the other women and for her daughter. And I thought that was really interesting that when it came to her, that she was more hesitant to go do the repetition. Like, there was almost not a sense of confidence or belief in herself that she could do it. And so with some gentle kind of goading, she did it. And she did it, and it was beautiful. And we all just stopped and clapped and cheered. And she looked at herself, and there was a mirror. She looked at herself, and she said, I did it. I did it. And that was just so impactful. That was one of the greatest takeaways for me, was restoring that belief back into yourself. And so when we talk about our research, one of the researchers mentioned, and this comes out in trauma studies, especially using like things like exercise and movement, is again that mind and body connection. And then also for women in particular, you know, when we think about sports, again, like, we have this very masculine perspective that sports is all about strength and physicality, but like reframing the way that we think about strength and who's considered to be strong. What I've learned from Dr. Noelle Brigden, who's a powerlifter, and she also does trauma-informed powerlifting, and the ideas about what kinds of bodies do we consider to be strong. And in the powerlifting world, like, you know, some of the strongest women in the world don't look like our typical conceptions of what strength is. That is very muscular, you know, very muscular physiques. But these are some of the strongest women in the world who are winning powerlifting competitions at a global level. And so it completely reframes our idea about what is strength. And jujitsu is exactly that, because it's not really based on strength. It's focused on technique. Strength does help. But for women, it's what I've noticed is a little bit of a different experience when they start jujitsu, and including myself, because you do have that conception that strength means physicality and muscularity. But when we come to jujitsu and you look at some of the top competitors in the world, especially amongst the women, they're very small. Their physiques are very small.
And we're going to get into talking about your journey with jujitsu. Sociologist Amber Tucker combines her mixed martial arts background to empower women. Are you living with trauma? Do you feel comfortable going to a gym? Are there exercise skills you wish you had? What questions do you have about transforming painful emotions into confidence, into assertiveness? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Amber Tucker here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the Restorative Justice in Movement program on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, jujitsu, as we've been learning, is much more than just combative martial arts. It's being used to help women in their recovery from trauma. Have you learned martial arts and rediscovered something inside of you? Did learning jujitsu make you less afraid of something you carry with you in your life? 800-642-1234. Cardinal Stritch University sociologist Amber Tucker is a mixed martial artist, and with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring on a caller now. Jean is joining us from Glenflora. Jean, hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. What is your story?
Well, I'm 70 years old, and I have starting to have some problems with arthritis. Well, actually, I've had them for quite a few years, but they were minor. But I've had quite a few minor accidents along the way, wear and tear on the body, and I can't lift heavy weights anymore, or it's hard to practice explosive martial arts training. But I wanted to mention Tai Chi as an option for older people with arthritis, particularly Sun Tai Chi. Tai Chi originated as a martial art many centuries ago in China, and all the concentration skills, all the balance skills, all the training skills are employed there. It can be either individual or group. I practice in both, it's just very helpful for mental strength and for balance. And also, the training for strength is isometric. It's very gentle, but it's really nice for older people who may have some physical problems that limit their ability to really do explosive types of martial art.
Yes, Jean, thank you so much for bringing Tai Chi into the conversation. Amber, Jean is saying it's for concentration and mental strength. What do you hear about Tai Chi?
Absolutely. I practiced it for a little while in my early days before I really got involved into other forms of martial arts, and I absolutely agree. Like I said, there's just been some newer research on that specifically focused on jujitsu, but I mentioned the other martial arts as well, and I think it's the idea between the mind and body connection and thinking about strength differently and what that means for different bodies and different people. Notions of strength don't all have the same universal meaning. They mean something differently. And so absolutely, it's that trauma experience that disconnects your mind from your body, where your body does one thing, but your mind does the other. And so any form of mindfulness practice like meditation or martial arts, I think, is really helpful in restoring that connection.
Let's bring on Emily now in Madison. Hi, Emily.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I listen to this every morning. It's really exciting.
Oh, thank you, Emily. What's on your mind?
Yeah, so I'm really interested to hear how I can help my mom get movement into her life. I know she deals with trauma, but it's not like disclosed about what. So she's so disconnected from her body, and I want to support her, and I'm going to be seeing her over the holidays, and it's such a touchy topic for us, exercise.
Emily, thank you so much. Amber, what would you suggest?
And it doesn't necessarily have to be movement exercises. So I also practice mindfulness. I do meditation and I do yoga. And there's research, a lot more research around that, about mindfulness practices like meditation and yoga that also helps in trauma recovery. So that's one way to approach it. If exercise or movement forms seem like that's not the right thing for right now. That kind of stuff. And then also, you know, therapy. But one of the things I can say in working with trauma survivors and as a survivor of trauma is that, you know, people sometimes and not always will come to tell their stories or disclose. And sometimes people just live with it. And so, you know, I think that that's, you bring up something really interesting. How do the people who have relationships with people who are trauma survivors, how can we support those people in supporting the people in their lives that experience trauma? So that is I'm really glad that you brought that up, because it sounds like there is something that we have to think about people who are supporting those people, relationships, you know, children or, you know, siblings or just family members. And how can we support people in that kind of way? What kind of resources can we give them to help them if they're not even at the point where, you know, the acknowledgement of trauma is possible?
It sounds too that your intergenerational clinics might help inform that, as well as you see those interactions between mothers and daughters.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, and I'm not sure of any other types of programs that would include the intergenerational work, but we specifically focus on intergenerational work because, you know, trauma is not just held within one person in the family, and it passes down through generations. It impacts the way that we, women specifically, while we work with mothers, it impacts the way that you mother. It impacted the way that I mother. But I was personally at a place where I was able to, it took me a long time, you know, it took me 30 plus years to even acknowledge the fact that I was dealing and coping with trauma before I started to do something about it. So just the ability to be able to acknowledge it, I think, is an important step. And that's also a source of strength too. And so people will come into their own when they're able to share that. But, you know, you can offer other alternatives to exercise and movement like meditation or yoga. Yoga is a very gentle way to still be able to do some work on the body and also kind of work through those things like reestablishing the mind-body connection. So maybe you can offer up some trauma. You can go, you know, or offer up yoga. You can go to YouTube, and there are some great people during the pandemic. I taught myself yoga on YouTube, and now I go to actual yoga classes. So maybe that could be an option.
We're talking with Amber Tucker, who is an assistant professor of sociology at Cardinal Stritch University in Milwaukee, as we look closer at the Restorative Justice and Movement program. Amber, how did jiu-jitsu come into your life? Could you tell us the story?
Absolutely. I've always been into fitness, and I've kind of trained myself, you know, over time, just going to the gym. And I was looking for a new way to exercise or to move. And the gym that I'm at now is a mixed martial arts academy, but they had a fitness program for women, and they would have the fighters teach it. And the classes ended, and the owner suggested that we move over to the traditional classes. And I looked over at those classes and I saw the close body contact, and I was like, I don't think I could do it. And later I ended up doing it, and I got a better workout out of training in the classes than taking the actual fitness class. And then after a couple years, I just started with striking, with kickboxing, and I would see the people doing jiu-jitsu. It's ground combat. There are people on the ground on top of each other. It's co-ed. And that, you know, kind of freaked me out a little bit. And, you know, someone had said to me, you should think about jiu-jitsu. You can probably defend yourself standing up, but what happens if you go to the ground? And more than likely, you know, with small people or women, that's sometimes where the fight happens, is on the ground. And so jiu-jitsu is so empowering. I teach a women's only jiu-jitsu program. And whenever new women join the gym, I tell them, you know, of course, all the martial arts offer the same kind of benefits in terms of confidence and self-awareness and sense of self-safety. But what's so powerful about the jiu-jitsu is we fight on our backs. So the fight isn't over when we're on our backs. You know, we can do, you know, different techniques that can choke you, put you to sleep, that can break your limbs on your back. And so it's so empowering to see some of the women and even the smaller children. I teach a class on Friday nights where the children from the jiu-jitsu class come over, and I have to warn the adults that these 7 and 8 year olds are more they're more dangerous than the other adults. And it's so interesting to see like some of the new people that come in, and they don't take me seriously. And the next thing I know, they're complaining about one of the kids. And I was like, does, but that's what jiu-jitsu does. It's really for all body types and all levels. I compete too. I'm a competitor. And with something super powerful, I was at a tournament this summer, and we had people competing in these highly ranked, like, international, national tournaments who had complete losses of vision. Mm. They're blind competitors. And they still were, you know, and they were at the competition level. So it's a very intense level. And so that really reaffirms my belief and faith in the power of martial arts being adaptable too. You know, and again, that our research is focusing on that idea of like what bodies, what is our notion of like what's a healthy body, what's a strong body. And it's not the stuff that we see on TV and in magazines.
Well, Amber, we'll be watching this research. Thank you for joining us. Amber Tucker is an assistant professor of sociology at Cardinal Stritch University in Milwaukee, part of the Restorative Justice in Movement research team. Coming up, we meet the mayor of Dodgeville. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Just a quick heads up on the issue of election maps in Wisconsin. WPR continues to put out episodes of our podcast, WPR Reports Mapped Out. The latest episode is available at WPR.org/mappedout. Now, Lake Michigan's water levels have fluctuated for the past century, but for people who live and work along the shoreline, they are seeing the most dramatic shifts in their lifetimes. It's a trend that climate experts tie to climate change. As Wisconsin Watch's Mario Coran reports, that threatens property along the shoreline and poses major challenges for local governments, private homeowners, and even state parks.
Waves are crashing under the shore of Door County's Whitefish Dune State Park. They're carrying fine sand that wind stacks into towering dunes. Wind and water have sculpted this landscape, but those same forces are whittling away at it. In high water years, waves erode dunes and swallow the beach.
The kind of sand we have here is super, super fine, so it blows in really well when the dunes are forming, but it also washes away really easily.
That's park manager Sarah Stepanek.
So we get one bad storm and you can have an incredible difference from even just a week before.
On a windy morning in late September, she surveyed damage from recent year's high water. Lake Michigan swelled by more than 6 feet from a record low in 2013 to a record high last year. The water is lower now, but still higher than average. Scientists say rising temperatures and more frequent storms could be driving the fluctuations. These two factors create a tug-of-war between precipitation and evaporation. That leads to giant shifts. Low water usually leaves about 100 yards of beach for walking and sunbathing at Whitefish Dunes. Stepanek says last year's high water left just 10 to 20 feet of beach, while the pandemic had visitors flocking to state parks.
Last year was insane, though. We had almost double what our typical visitation is. And then our beach was about half as wide as it is now, which it's not very wide now even. So to pack all those people on the beach was a challenge.
Storms and high water inflicted other damage too.
Down on our third beach access, the dune was undermined so severely that it literally was like a 15-foot drop off of the side of the dune down to the beach. We had to install a staircase there twice because the first time we installed it, about 5 days later, we had a big storm and it completely undermined the staircase. It was hanging 5 feet off the ground. So we had to install it a second time.
Other lakeshore parks face similar challenges. The wheelchair accessible ramp to the water at Point Beach State Forest in Manitowoc County is still mangled and useless 3 years after a winter storm knocked it out.
You have to remember it's Mother Nature. And you never know what to expect.
Park supervisor Aaron Dembski Rodriguez says she requested repairs soon after the ramp was damaged, but that funding moves slowly when it's available at all. DNR's regional parks manager Michael Burgum says the repairs backlog at state parks dramatically eclipses available funds.
There's literally close to almost $1 billion worth of projects that have not yet been funded within the capital development system.
A recent Wisconsin Policy Forum report called Wisconsin parks woefully underfunded. Only Alabama spends less per resident on state park operations. But even with unlimited funding, it's not clear whether certain fixes are worthwhile. Fortifying the shoreline could limit erosion, but Berkham says they're also trying to preserve nature as it is.
We want to provide activities and facilities for our guests, but we also want to have a sense of conservatorship to conserve a lot of the resource. And that's a constant battle. So to me, the shoreline issue is analogous to that. How much do we try to do to preserve the shoreline, and how much do we understand that that's part of the process that occurs?
Stepanek says the trick is to keep the park accessible even when water levels make that difficult. That might include ditching a fixed dock for one that floats and letting nature take its course elsewhere in the park.
We do want to figure out how to make it more usable even in years when, you know, the lake isn't agreeing with us.
Climate scientists say that if current trends continue, the lake is likely to only become less agreeable. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Mario Curran.
And this story was produced in collaboration with Wisconsin Watch. Now we're talking with mayors from all over Wisconsin. Our next stop is Dodgeville, county seat for Iowa County and part of the Madison Metropolitan Statistical Area. Dodgeville has just shy of 5,000 residents. Do you live there? What questions do you have for your mayor? Do you work at Land's End? What do you think of the relationship the company has with Dodgeville? 800-642-1234. Todd Novak has been Dodgeville's mayor since 2012, represents the city and its surrounding counties of Iowa and Lafayette in the state assembly, a dual role he has held since 2015. Mayor Novak, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, good to be here. Glad to talk to you.
Good morning. So Iowa County, where you are, has had more than 3,100 confirmed COVID cases, more than 3,200 residents with confirmed or probable cases. How has the pandemic and this disease affected Dodgeville?
It's affected us as it has in many areas of the rest of the state. The shutdowns were very hard when it first started in the beginning. I have several restaurants, as you know. Also, we're a very big tourist area in Southwest Wisconsin. It's a huge economic driver in Dodgeville and the surrounding areas, so that had an effect on that. Also, we have Upland Hills Health, which is a great hospital located in Dodgeville, and so, you know, at first when everything was going on, I think they were a little overwhelmed, and now they seem to be doing good, handling everything on back to full speed. So it's just something that you need to be cautious of. I'm vaccinated. I just urge people to be vaccinated, and hopefully we can get rid of this at some point.
What aid is Dodgeville receiving from the federal government, and how are you putting it to use?
We have received about, or had not totally yet, we're expected to receive about $493,000. There are some things that we will be doing. Part of what we're going to be using on our EMS service, Dodgeville has a very large, we have three ambulances, 42-member crew, mostly volunteer crew. We have are transitioning to a full-time ambulance crew. So that's, some of the money will go towards that. We have an average of 1,000 calls a year for EMS. So we're also looking at some infrastructure spending. And we really have not sat down and put pen to paper yet of kind of what we're going to do with it right now. We're just use it as a discretionary fund when we need it for COVID-related expenses or other expenses that pop up.
Are you worried about using it for ongoing costs? I mean, when I look at a full-time ambulance crew, that is more than a one-off, one-year thing.
We were able to, through budgeting through the years, to we've actually built up a healthy balance in our ambulance account, so we'll be able to do that because we've been planning to do this for 4 or 5 years. So we've been budgeting very close to the vest, and we'll be able to sustain that. I'm fortunate, Dodgeville. Our ambulance service actually runs in the black. Many ambulance services, especially in rural Wisconsin, don't. And so I'm very fortunate in that aspect.
Moving on to the business community, Dodgeville, of course, home to the headquarters for Land's End Clothing Company, employs thousands in your area. What is it like for the city to be really dominated by one large employer?
Well, we've had our ups and downs. Lands End is about 15% of Dodgeville's tax base. You know, we had the founder of Lands End, Gary Comer, the city of Dodgeville and Gary Comer had a very unique relationship, and he was very good to the community. For example, he built the city swimming pool, the Gary Comer pool, gave tens of thousands of dollars a year back to the community through the United Way or various different organizations. When Lands End got sold years ago, that relationship kind of changed, and Lands End went from a more hometown type business to a corporate business. So Dodgeville and Lands End had a few years of rocky relationships. However, that has been repaired, and they have a new CEO, Jerome Griffiths, and him and I actually become really good friends. We talk to each other usually every quarter, every couple months, just keep each other updated. I think that, you know, we understand how important they are to Dodgeville, and he understands how important Dodgeville and the surrounding areas to him as far as workforce.
That's what I'm curious about. What are those communication channels like between the company and local government, and what comes up in your conversations?
You know, I can't go into specifics. You know, we have a very, we've developed friendship too, but, you know, he lets me know any important news. You know, a couple times during some down periods up there, they had to lay off people. He called me immediately before it was even announced to the public or the employees, actually, what was going on, to give me a heads up, how many people. Immediately after, for example, the COVID, when COVID hit and the shutdown and everything, he immediately called me up and gave me their plan, keeping people work from home. Their workforce, what they were doing. So we have that kind of communication. He's really good. The communication is really good. Or if I've got anything going on in Dodgeville, I will let him know. For example, Quick Trip was looking to add on to their store, and Lands End owned land next to where they were looking. And I just made one call to Lands End and said, hey, just so you know, Quick Trip's looking, and they just cut the ribbon cutting in a couple of weeks ago. So so that's kind of how I do things. So
Relationships. Lands End third quarter fiscal results, as you know, came out earlier this month, and it reported lower than expected third quarter revenue. And just like other retailers, really struggling with supply chain challenges. How closely and concerned do you watch the fiscal health of your company's largest, you know, your community's largest employer?
I watch it close. However, I've been through the ups and downs with that company, and so I have full faith in their success. And I think actually they're projected to do probably better this season than what you think, from what I'm hearing. So I think they're going to have a good Christmas. You know, a lot of their business is between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And but yes, your supply chain is not affecting just Lands End; it's affecting almost every business in my city. So it's a huge problem.
Dodgeville Mayor Todd Novak with us explaining the issues he is taking on in his city in the heart of southwestern Wisconsin's uplands. How do you want Dodgeville to use pandemic relief aid? Have you struggled to find housing in Dodgeville? We'll talk about that. What are the biggest issues in the southwest part of the state? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're in conversation with mayors from all over Wisconsin here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dodgeville Mayor Todd Novak, also a state assemblyman from the area, here as we look at issues in his community roughly 45 miles west of Madison with outdoor recreational assets. We haven't talked about this. Do you bike, hike, or canoe in the area? What is your impression of Dodgeville? Join in 800-642-1234. Mayor Todd Novak with us for about 9 more minutes. Mayor, you know, we've talked to so many communities, so many city leaders who are really struggling to provide housing, all different types of housing. What does that situation, the housing situation, look like for Dodgeville?
I'm in the same boat. A house goes on the market here and it's gone, and usually goes for higher than the listing price. I actually, the city just, we have a TID district, just about 3 months ago sold 7 acres in that TID district to some developers that build apartments, and I am in the, they're in the process right now of building 96 units of market rate apartments. So it's kind of a boom for the city currently.
A TID district, a tax incremental district. Can you explain how that works?
So what happens in the TID district, the Dodgeville is out of land. I would get calls all the time, does the city have any this land available, or two lots, or this, that? We didn't. So we bought 63 acres of land from a farmer next to the city of Dodgeville. And a TID district is where you put in the infrastructure, and the city sells the lots or whatever, and all the taxpayers in that TID district, the taxes stay there, and that pays for everything in that TID district. So the apartment complex that is going up will be 96 units to start, by the time they're all done, it'll be a $15 million valuation. So it's kind of a big deal. So, and it's much needed. The developers did a market study here and determined there was a huge need. So,
huge need. Do you see that you'll need more of that type of housing, of multi-unit housing?
I believe so. And he has an option to buy some additional acreage to put in another 48 units, I believe. So, I think we're in the proximity of Madison. Mm-hmm. So rents are high in Madison. Rents are high in Verona. You have Mount Horeb. So we're kind of next to the line. We're kind of unique. We're probably about 35, 40 minutes from Madison and 35, 40 minutes from Dodge or from Dubuque, Iowa. So, and with four lane surrounding us, we're a hub community. So we're seeing that growth of people moving in from the Madison area, where it's 30 minutes to drive to the very far west side and work and live here. So there's a lot of that. So it's definitely needed.
Let's talk about you for a moment here. You have this unique role in Dodgeville, serving both as mayor and the representative in the state assembly. How do you balance out those two jobs?
Well, other days, I wonder. the mayor is a part-time job. The city of Dodgeville doesn't have a city administrator. We're about the only city this size that doesn't. However, we've got some crack top staff. I have a public works director that's a municipal engineer. I've got a great clerk. I've got a finance HR person. So it works. So I balance the two. It actually helps me in both jobs. To do both jobs in the assembly, I'm chairman of the local government committee.
Mm-hmm.
So that keeps me really connected to the League of Municipalities, Counties Association, Towns Association. So I know, I can speak the language of local government. But, also other aspects, my assembly district, I go down to Monroe, almost to Richland Center. So if a business or somebody's looking to locate in Dodgeville and I don't quite have what they need here, I'll say, hey, you should check Monroe. I know that they have this land or maybe this storefront or Darlington. So I do a lot of that. I cross over because I've got connections all over the district.
That crossover probably serves the community well because, certainly what Dodgeville may not have, as you mentioned, Monroe or some other community in your area might have in southwestern Wisconsin.
Yeah, definitely does. And I, my role as assemblyman, I keep in touch with those communities. Local government is my wheelhouse or forte, I should say. So, I know most elected officials in every district, every municipality. So, got that great relationship so we can pass information along.
Mm-hmm. We have Todd Novak, who's been mayor of Dodgeville since 2012. As we are in conversation with mayors from all over Wisconsin, you can join in if you live in Dodgeville, you have ideas, 800-642-1234. You worked for years as a reporter and an editor for the Dodgeville Chronicle. How important is the function of local media to smaller communities like Dodgeville?
It is very important. Yeah, I was 25 years associate editor of the Dodgeville Chronicle before I got into this. I'm not kind of sure why I got into this, but I just got a door. When a door opens, you got to kind of try to go through it. That's my philosophy. So the media is very important. I'm very fortunate. I have an assembly district that has 8 weekly newspapers. Covered by we're covered out here by 2 state papers. Wisconsin State Journal covers things out here, and so does the Telegraph out in Dubuque. Local media is very important, especially in this day and age of mergers, buyouts, and everything. So, you know, the Dodgeville Chronicle, my old paper, covers school board, county board, city council very well. I'm old school. I still think, you know, we have a more senior population out in this area. They like to read the paper versus, I think, getting their information online.
You sponsored legislation earlier this year to help local media, to help local newspapers stay alive. Why did you put forth that legislation?
Because I think the local media is important. You know, it's a tax credit for businesses that if they advertise on the radio, TV, or newspaper, and have under, I can't remember how much sales a year, 10 million, less than 10 million, or 10 million or less in sales, they get a $5,000 tax credit. You know, the COVID affected newspapers and the media tremendously too. Yeah, as I noted when my prior career as a newspaper, so I'm kind of not only a local government guru in the state assembly, I'm also the newspaper guy, they call me. So I work very closely with the Wisconsin Newspaper Association. And so I think it's important.
Well, how about we land on tourism here? You're in the Driftless. You are just an absolute magnet for hikers and bicyclists and fishers. How has that been in the pandemic?
It was hard. You know, I've got Governor Dodge, which is huge. I call it the best state park in the state. I know some of my colleagues disagree with me, but it's a busy park. And, you know, you go 5 miles to the south, I got Mineral Point, which is huge for the arts community. You go to the north 10 miles, I've got Taliesin, Frank Lloyd Wright, American Players Theater, Spring Green. So Dodgeville's in the hub of it all. So tourism is huge here. And I've got the House in the Rock. And in the summer, in a busy summer, pre-COVID, you know, the streets are full. You can't find a parking space. It's just a huge economic driver. And I know, talking to the park managers at Governor Dodge, I mean, in the summers, they're full. Those people come into town. So it's important.
Well, Mayor Novak, thank you for joining us.
It's good to be here, and thank you.
Todd Novak, mayor of Dodgeville since 2012, represents the city and its surrounding counties of Iowa and Lafayette in the assembly. Just ahead, it's our Ask a Contractor series as we head into the garage to find out solutions for common flooring problems for organization. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.